And it's with movie reviews that we start this evening. Up for your consideration, Edward Fennell's controversial rape revenge story, Promising Young Woman. Andy Samberg gets caught in an infinite time loop in Palm Springs. And Netflix brings us Love and Monsters, a film that's big on CGI, but is it big on heart as well? Ruth Barton and Donald Clark have been to the virtual cinema for us. They're with me, they join me now, rather, on the line. And we'll start with Promising Young Woman first, released this weekend on Sky Cinema and Now TV. Tells the story of Cassie, a medical school dropout, hell-bent on avenging the rape of her best friend, Nina. Directorial debut from the multi-talented writer, director and actor, Emerald Fennell. And it stars Carey Mulligan as the aforementioned young woman who is Cassie, who is hell-bent on revenge. Ruth, set the scene for us here. She's turning 30. Life is not in the best state for the character of Cassie when we meet her. What's she up to?
Yeah, she's living with her parents and she's waitressing, so she's certainly not living up to the expectations of somebody who's got herself to med school. So this seems to be a fairly kind of mundane life by day, but by night it all turns into something quite different, because by night she disguises herself as somebody who's kind of, you know, very glitzy. She looks, you know, younger than her 30, but the main thing is she's drunk out of her mind. And so she then puts herself in a position where men in bars will come on to her. They pretend to be solicitors. They say they're going to bring her home and look after her, but of course then they try to have sex with her. And at that point, they realise, uh-oh, she's not drunk, and she's going to have her revenge for an incident that happened that has affected her very badly.
Well, let's listen to a scene where we get precisely that setup that you're speaking about. Carey Mulligan as Cassie. She's with a guy called Neil at this point, played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse, and suddenly things change from the direction he thought they were going.
I just thought that you were...
drunk?
Yeah.
Really drunk?
Fuck. Yeah.
Well, I'm not. But that's good, isn't it?
I think you should leave.
Oh. Now you want me to leave?
No, I'm really high. Like, I'm really fucking high right now. I don't know what I'm doing. I think you should go.
But a second ago, you were determined for me to stay. You were pretty insistent, actually.
I'm a nice guy.
Are you?
I thought we had a connection, I guess.
A connection? Okay. What do I do for a living? Sorry, maybe that one's too hard. How old am I? How long have I lived in the city? What are my hobbies? What's my name?
Carey Mulligan there as Cassie in a scene from Promising Young Woman. Donald, it clearly we're dealing with a very, very serious topic in this film.
We are. And it's had an interesting history, this film. I would say we've got the Oscars next week. And I think there are two films that have actually profited from the hiatus and the confusion of COVID. One is Sound of Metal and the other is Promising Young Woman. Neither of which I think would have been up for Best Picture, as both are, if that hadn't happened. Which is not to say that I'm in any way criticising either film. I think those two are among my three favourite of the nominated films. But this film was originally supposed to be released in the awards unfriendly spring of 2020. I actually saw it in a regular press show maybe 2 weeks before the shutters came down in late February, early March. So they had no great intention, no great notions that it was going to be an awards sort of an awards friendly movie. At that stage, they were putting it out into kind of, as I say, in a sort of wasteland then. And like Sound of Metal, it's built up this momentum as the time has gone on, with critics, with festival audiences, with people in the industry, and has ended up being nominated for Best Picture, and I think 6 nominations in total, and has a chance of competing in quite a few of those. At the same time, what's happened, the downside to that, as far as they're concerned, is a lot more attention, serious attention has come onto it. And there's been quite a lot of negative criticism of it the last few weeks. A lot of people now really hate it. A lot of people now think that it doesn't take the subject seriously enough. There's a notion that it's not responsible enough towards its unseen victim. And the particular, a lot of criticism of the ending, which we can't really discuss here, but get at that. And what's interesting, a lot of that is coming from female critics. At the same time, one should say, unless we get into this cheapening notion of like it's all one demographic like it and one doesn't, it did win with Best Film with the Online Association of Film Critics and the Women's Film Critics Circle over Nomadland. I think those are all serious points worth making, but I still am very fond of this, as fond of this film as I was a year ago. I think it works kind of like a Jacobean tragedy in that sense, Jacobean revenge tragedy. And it has that same sort of notion of the convolution being part of the point, the coincidences being part of the attraction of the thing, and the sheer unreasonableness of it being part of the fun.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually end with, you know, with Titus Andronicus feeding his enemies' daughter's children in a pie, but it sort of goes in that same sort of direction. And I think it works very well in its broad way, though I can understand why some people have reservations about it.
Yeah, there was some criticism, though, levelled at Kerry Mulligan and whether she was good casting for this part or not. And
that was
withdrawn in some ways as well, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't withdrawn by the writer.
No.
It was withdrawn by Variety. Who published an apology for the writer's own opinions over the review, which you can have your own view in that one way or the other. But I mean, it did not strike me as a very responsible way of dealing with that particular criticism. But yes, well, that's interesting because that kind of comes in some ways from an opposite direction to the criticism we're getting now. Which is in a sense objecting to it not being responsible enough in its feminism. Which I can understand. I would also say I think Kerry Mulligan is really good in it. I think, you know, I absolutely disagree with what the critics said in that review. I think she's really good in it, and she's really good. Part of the challenge that she has, which she overcomes brilliantly, she's playing about four different versions of this character. Because, like, you have, for example, right at the beginning, she appears in this apparently drunken state as a vulnerable victim, and then she swivels around on a dime whenever one of the guys takes her home and becomes this avenging angel. And then there's this sort of kind of, you know, whacked out loser in her parents' house who are driving each other crazy. So she actually kind of, like, I think very effectively succeeds in playing three or four versions
of this,
versions of the same character.
Which is what the character is. It is this kind of multifaceted. Yeah. This multifaceted. Cassie herself is performing roles in the things that she's doing. But also very interesting in terms of casting here, Ruth, is that there's a whole set of privileges around this. The young men that are presented in this particular rape story that is at the centre of the plot, and in the unfolding of the plot as it goes along, they're all very privileged young men, and very interesting casting there.
Yeah, very interesting casting, because in that clip that we've just played, as you said, that's Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who's much better known as Superbad, you know, as McLovin from Superbad. Then you have Adam Brody turning up. He's Seth from the OC. And you have all these, like, good guy actors who are, you know, very much kind of millennial favourites. They're, you know, clean young men. Mm. And in the film, they played the mostly... They're either med students or young professionals, depending on which part of the story we're in. And so the kind of argument, I think it is very good on how privilege steps in and covers up when something, you know, really awful happens. And I think it's also quite nice that 7 years have passed since this incident, because the film is also asking us, oh, well, 7 years ago, maybe we weren't as alert to rape culture as we are now. But then when she starts talking to people of her own age, and particularly also one of the women, a woman called Madison, who they were all at med school together, Madison hasn't changed her mind. Madison thinks that it's unreasonable to go after the guys who did this. So there is a nice kind of historicity, which actually goes right back to Night of the Hunter, where there's a clip from Night of the Hunter where you have Robert Mitchum playing this, you know, deranged, woman-hating preacher who's just, you know, so turned on by women. He hates himself and he hates them. And then you go forward in time to the rape sequence, and then you come right up to the present. And I think the film is saying, you know, how much actually have attitudes changed?
Just staying with you for a final comment, Ruth, Donald mentioned this idea of the Jacobean tragedy, which it kind of makes me think about it in a rather different way, and suddenly the implausibilities become acceptable. Did you find some of the implausibilities of plot, because it does become convoluted, And it is quite high flown towards the end in terms of the way the whole thing is resolved. Did those improbabilities, implausibilities bother you?
No, not at all. I mean, what I found was I came away with this huge impression. I mean, it really kind of hit me viscerally, in part through its aesthetic. And no, the story doesn't add up. And there are fundamentally two endings, because they had one ending for the film and the producer said, no, that's too downbeat. And so they have, so they basically end the film once and then they do it again a second time. And so it's messy at the end. But at the same time, it's the overall effect, I think, that you take from it. And I think it's really going to hit that demographic that needs to engage with this and wants to engage with this.
Stars from you, Ruth?
I gave it 4.5 out of 5.
And overall, and stars from you, Donald?
I have 4 stars as well, yeah.
So very positive from both Donald and Ruth for Promising Young Woman, the first of our 3 films up for review this evening. Let's move on then to Palm Spring, a film that certainly flies close to Groundhog territory, Groundhog Day territory. Niles and Sarah are caught in an endlessly repeating wedding day in this rom-com, which is out now on Amazon Prime Video. It makes us look at the trap of our own everyday lives in many ways. you kind of have to say it. Here we go again. it is Groundhog Day, this film. The idea of the repeated day over and over again at a wedding, Donald. But are they doing something different here? Something new?
Yes. I mean, I think that you're right in that this is not the notion of characters being trapped in a time loop. It has been done other places since in the movies. Russian Dolls, actually, wasn't a film, it was a television series recently, has another crack at this, the Netflix series that did it very well. The Doug Liman film, Edge of Tomorrow, another variation on this. But this is much closer to Groundhog Day than either of those projects, because it actually does take a guy over a day, and one of his objectives is to win over the girl. But the differences really matter. And one of the differences is we start in media res. We start with him already in the loop, so we don't have that surprise. But the significant difference is that we have the female character arriving in the loop with him. And so they're struggling together on this. And that adds a different dynamic to the whole philosophy of it. And it also, I think, vitally gives her some agency, because part of the problem, well, not that there were many problems with Groundhog Day, it is a classic, but a potential problem with Groundhog Day is it's really all about him, and she's essentially this target that he pursues over possibly thousands of years, who knows, but certainly over hundreds and hundreds of days. In this case, I think Christine Milioti, who plays female lead, has actually given some scope to actually break out and form the character. And I think that works very nicely. The setting is obviously is vital to this. They have set it in Palm Springs, so you have that kind of nether world that is this town in the middle of a desert. That adds another aspect, another flavour of weirdness to it, unless you're from Palm Springs, in which case it's perfectly ordinary. But to us, that's another degree of weirdness to it.
Okay, let's listen to a clip from Palm Springs. And here, Niles and Sarah, Andy Samberg and Christine Milioti, as you say, attending the wedding for the umpteenth time and trying to make it interesting for themselves by doing some high-level play acting. The couple, this is the Christine Milioti's sister, as in the character's sister, they're about to cut the cake.
Wait! Stop! There's a bomb in the cake. Don't worry. I used to be a bomb guy. Everyone stand back!
Bitch, you ruined my plan!
Sarah, the sister of the bride, and based on her accent, from origins unknown, I'll take her dead or alive.
Put the weapon down.
Fine, then it's to be hand-to-hand combat then.
Oh my God, Niles!
There you go, Christine Milioti and Andy Samberg as the loving couple at the centre of this particular film that we're speaking about, Palm Springs. Ruth, when this started, I thought, here we go. Come on, we've all seen Groundhog Day. Come on, you don't really expect me to watch this again and again and again, do you? And then I found myself being teased in and laughing out loud several times. It's hard to write a good rom-com. It's hard to act a good rom-com. I think we may be close to having one here.
Oh, I share your thoughts on this, because I knew it was going to be a loop film, and So during my first day at the wedding, I thought, oh no, not again, and again, and again. But each time they play it again, they add something in. And there are some really smart twists to it. And you get that sequence, which is really funny. But then it goes off into, you know, into really introspective territory, because it really is asking, you know, a fundamental existential question, which is, do I accept my lot in life and keep going? Or do I grasp hold of the opportunity for free will, and do I blast myself out of this existence and take my chances? And, you know, Niels is he's kind of happy with the way things are going, because he's kind of got the girl at this stage, and really, what more does a guy want? And actually, there's another character called Roy who has also got caught up.
That's the J.K. Simmons character.
Yeah, and he's also got caught up in this infinite time loop, which is something, you know, that happened as a consequence of one of the wedding scenes where he wishes this day would last forever. He gets it, and so he's out to get Niels, but then he decides, actually. It's, you know, I'm kind of okay with it. I live with it. Whereas, you know, she's really pushing to break free. And I just have to say, you have to watch. Don't stop at the end of the film. Go to the
end.
With the credits, because there's a sequence after the credits have started rolling that you go, oh man.
Donald mentioned it there again, the case of Christine Milioti, but there's some great performances here. J.K. Simmons and Andy Samberg was really likable.
Oh, he's fantastic in it. And actually, Peter Gallagher, you know, who always plays this kind of sardonic bad guy, he turns up doing sardonic brilliantly, and it's only a very small role, but you can't take your eyes off him.
And Donald, you know, as I said to Ruth, I found myself being sucked into it further and further, and laughing and laughing. Now maybe I'm getting soft of coming towards the end of a tough lockdown. Then I found myself kind of with a lump in my throat at a couple of points as well towards the end. It does that thing that a rom-com should do. It kind of shifts from one to the other, from kind of laughing to, I know I was totally manipulated by the material, but that's okay, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly okay, and we tend to forget that the romantic comedy is one of the great genres in Hollywood. It's delivered some of the greatest films that Hollywood has made, and they have almost ceased to exist as, I'll use this phrase delicately, in the current climate, theatrical releases in the current climate. They basically ran them into the ground with the schooly, rather ropey, what they then called chick flicks with Jennifer Aniston in the early part of this century. And people stopped watching them because they got so bad. So it's a delight whenever someone... But one of the few places you do find them now is in the independent sector. This is essentially an indie film, and they tend to do it right, and you find a few kind of... go through that portal into Netflix. So the fact that they're making a decent film within one of the great Hollywood genres is, I think, a delight. And it had a peculiar history. It was worth noting as one of those films that broke the record at Sundance, which is an unhappy film. Not every film that broke that record has got on success. Birth of a Nation famously crashed a few years ago. Others have done better. But it was so far at 17.5 million at Sundance. So somebody out there thinks there is still a hunger for this sort of romantic comedy, or for romantic comedies of any sort. And it's delightful that they're being satisfied with a film that actually works.
Yeah, and how many stars is it getting from you, you old romantic?
Four.
Four from you. And Ruth, you other old romantic.
Yeah, I like that four. I was really surprised how much I liked it. Four.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, I certainly thought so too. Agreeing totally with both of you in that double 4 stars for Palm Springs. Let's move on then to Love and Monsters. Rom-coms can be formulaic. Love and Monsters, I think it's fairly safe to say, is a fairly formulaic setup again, Ruth, and follow through.
Yeah, I mean, this is somebody has read, you know, the screenplay manual on how you set up a narrative about finding your place in life if you're in your teens or in your early 20s by the time this character starts the story. So it's about this guy, Joel, played by Dylan O'Brien. 7 years ago, a massive asteroid landed on Earth. Humanity fought back with potent chemicals. And as a result, ordinary sort of common or garden insects, other small creatures, have turned into these massive mutant, angry monsters. He's hiding out in a bunker, but he wants to reconnect with his girlfriend of 7 years ago. And so he makes the journey across Earth to the other bunker. And because it's set up, you know, like a kind of video game, you have to acquire certain aids along the way, and you have to have certain encounters that are going to make you better at doing something or wiser about life. he has to go through all these things accompanied by a charming dog until he gets to the bunker, and then he can turn all these newly found skills to the to his advantage and face up against the monster.
Well, on his journey across, of course, he's going to have to meet some people in a kind of a quest-like situation who will teach him some lessons along the way. And here's one of those, Joel, played by Dylan O'Brien. He meets Minnow and Clyde, played by Ariana Greenblatt and Michael Rooker. They're fairly unimpressed by his skills in the survival skills, as it were.
One, two, three, four, and... Always count to five.
Was that a samurai sword?
Why'd you fall into a sand gobbler's nest?
I didn't mean to. I was walking.
What's your name?
Joel. Joel Dawson.
I'm Clyde. This is Minnow.
You're lucky we weren't monsters. You were yelling like a girl. Oh, this is bad. This is so bad.
Okay, I don't sound like that. My voice is not that high pitched.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it is.
It was higher than mine, and I'm eight.
What in God's name are you doing up here alone, anyway?
I'm not alone. I've got boy, too.
Hey. Oh, wait, no! Wait, wait, wait! Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's a puppy! Come here, boy! Come here, boy!
Hey, what's going on, dog?
Hi, boy! Hi!
So, what happened with your colony, man? They kick you out?
No, I actually left on my own. Something I had to do.
You stole food, didn't you?
He's a food stealer.
Yeah.
No, I didn't steal any food.
Right.
There you go. Scene from Love and Monsters, Dylan O'Brien as Joel, and Ariana Greenblatt and Michael Rooker as Minnow and Clyde, respectively. Donald, we're going to hear about stealing food. We know that because it's been set up in that scene that we're going to hear about it throughout the film. This is formulaic, but it kind of it does what it says on the tin, doesn't it? It brings
good.
Us through,
I mean,
places.
Yeah, I thought it was good. It's funny one, when the Oscar nominations landed last month, there was more than a few of us awards boars who had to admit that, in a rare twist, there was an American feature we'd never heard of. This is an Oscar-nominated film. It's taking up space in the best visual effects category that might have gone to Dune or Godzilla versus Kong, or one of the films that was either delayed or didn't turn up at all. Apparently there was some post-apocalyptic romp snuck out in the US during the autumn. Didn't sound promising. It's here on Netflix, and I think it's pretty good. We should probably, to damn with faint praise, celebrate what it's not for a start, given the nature of the film. It's not based on a comic. It's not a remake of a 1980s hit. It's not Ghostbusters. It's nothing to do with some intolerable YA novel about these professed individualists who end up slavishly defending their own sect. It's an original idea featuring unfamiliar... Well, not that original, but it is an, it's an original-ish idea featuring unfamiliar characters. And I think it works really well, not least because Dylan O'Brien, who survived the awful Maze Runner films, redeems himself as this young bumbler, gains wisdom travelling through monster-occupied territory. And also because the special effects guys, who I think sort of deserve their nomination, are really having fun. This is not one of those worlds where they work themselves to death creating a dull imaginary universe in which you think you could actually live. They actually have fun creating these wonderfully absurd creatures.
Giant snails, giant slugs.
Huge toads. And the script is fine. There are no points in the script where you groan at it. It's pretty reasonably sharp all the way through. I mean, one thing I would say about it is it's hard to know where it's pitched. We read out the story of the film and it sounds kind of like a family-friendly exercise. It's got kids in it, and more robust children would like it. But it is quite nasty at times.
Yeah, it is.
And at other times, it swings closer to a comedy horror like Zombieland.
Yeah,
but for me, it works well in both those areas.
Donald's saying a lot of things that it's not. The one thing that it struck me that it is or was doing, Ruth, towards the end of it, they have so set this up for the spin-off television series where these colonies, they can go around from one place to the next, they can meet loads of new people. But did the formula work in the way for you that it worked for Donald?
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, I think if there's, you know, more love, more monsters, I might check out of that one. But, you know, on the other hand, it was a totally amiable film. You know, I agree that it's kind of like a kid's movie, but too violent. The monsters were kind of gloopy, and you had to spend a couple of minutes thinking, oh, okay, it's snail, you know. but absolutely nothing wrong with it. Not my cup of tea, really, but, you know. well done them.
Yeah,
it's fun.
it follows the formula and it's perfectly acceptable for that. But probably one that would be nice to see on the big screen, to really see those giant slugs and giant spiders coming at us on the big screen.
And some of them good guys. Some of the monsters are good guys.
Yeah, so good guys. There's a test. Well. They have hearts too. You know, monsters have hearts too. Stars from you, Ruth.
I give it 3.5.
3.5 from you, Donald. I have a feeling you might be a little bit more generous on this one. Are you?
I think I'll stick with 3.5. Maybe an extra half up to the 4 for the excellent dog. It's one of the best.
I love the dog. Yeah, I love brilliant. The dog. Yeah.
So yeah, 4. I'm giving it 4. The extra half star is going towards boy the dog.
Boy the dog. Top performance. I agree with you on that as well. So those are our three films: Love and Monsters, A Promising Young Woman, and Palm Springs. Donald Clark and Ruth Barton are reviewers on this Thursday evening.